You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different. With the ESO Network Patreon, the cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With four tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at patreon.com/ESO Network.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 252 of the Earth Station DCU! Tonight we're going to talk Justice League Infinity number 2, Suicide Squad Get Joker number 1, Swamp Thing number 6, Crime Syndicate number 6, Batman 111, Green Lantern number 5, Justice League number 66, Sweet Tooth season 1 episode 5, What's in the Freezer, and the Suicide Squad movie. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, first up for DC news, Jeff Lemire and Dustin Guyen are reuniting for Robin and Batman, a 3-issue miniseries exploring the early days of Dick Grayson's sidekick career. Each issue will be 40 pages in prestige format and goes on sale November 9th, 2021.
I'll definitely be looking forward to checking that out. I mean, obviously, you and I both enjoy Robin's stories, and I think we both enjoy Jeff Lemire for the most part, so definitely looking forward to that series.
Yeah, I am too. I always love Batman and Robin stories, so especially Robin stories. All right, up next for DC News, 5 Robins will unite in a new title to hunt down Batman's first secret sidekick. Robins is written by Tim Seeley with art from Baldemar Riveras. Issue 1 releases November 16th. Very curious about this one because I don't know how I feel about Batman having a secret sidekick. Because it's going to kind of change Batman's history.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there. I don't know. It could be one of those things where it's a good story, but do I need it necessarily to affect any future Batman and Robin stories? Probably not.
I am excited about another Robin's, or, you know, all the Robins uniting for a story. That's the exciting part. But yeah, I'm just not that excited about a secret sidekick.
Yeah, I have to agree. That's not an appealing mystery for me personally, and obviously for you.
Yeah. So, all right. Up next for DC news, DC launches another Justice League series starring Thomas Wayne and President Superman and more. Justice League Incarnate will feature a multiversal team of superheroes defending the multiverse from Darkseid across Infinite Earths. Justice League Incarnate number 1 goes on sale November 2nd. I'm guessing that's going to be spinning out of Infinite Frontier.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. I mean, considering how prominently the team is featuring in that book.
So I'm hoping this is what that story is kicking into instead of another crisis.
Yeah, I don't think so.
You still think it's going to lead up to another crisis?
I am so sure.
Well, we both know how we feel about another crisis right now.
Yeah.
So we'll just have to see how it goes. I am interested in stories about the Justice League Incarnate, but I'm not wanting it to lead to another crisis. All right, up next for DC News, John Cena and James Gunn's Peacemaker series is a follow-up to the Suicide Squad movie, which will land on HBO in early 2022. The Peacekeeper series is being entirely written by James Gunn, who said he normally takes a break between movies, but I guess he had nothing better to do this past year, so.
I'm very excited for this show, and definitely you can tell. I know one of the Warner Brothers execs mentioned this, but you can definitely tell that they're making a point to try and spin stuff out from their movies into HBO Max, because we've got the Gotham something with the police department spinning out from the Batman film, and we've got Peacemaker coming out from Suicide Squad. So I think it's potentially good. I mean, if these shows are, you know, the same quality as the movies that we've seen recently, I think that'll be good. I just hope that they're picking them because they've got good potential and not just for the sake of having another HBO Max show.
I agree with you. I hope that's the case.
In this case, I am very excited for it. The fact that they have the, you know, James Gunn is still writing and directing a large portion of the show, that I'm excited for it because I liked what I saw in the movie. And if it's the same vision, that's what I want to see.
Me too. All right, and for our last bit of DC news, Doom Patrol Season 3 teaser trailer has announced that Doom Patrol is going to be back on September 23rd. So, not too far off.
I didn't realize it was coming up so soon, Drew.
I didn't either, because we didn't see anything about it. But because not too long ago we were talking about, when's Doom Patrol coming out?
Yeah.
So
yeah, I saw some version of the teaser. I don't know if I saw like the full teaser, but I saw it like as a commercial, like almost like it was intended to, in a sense, on TV. And I was like, wait, Doom Patrol's coming out that soon? And I got very excited. So I can't wait. I was honestly content with it coming out, you know, in a while, if not, maybe not even this year.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. Another thing, I might, since we're talking about DC news anyways, let me throw this out to you. Did you know Titans was on HBO Max already? They've already released 3 episodes.
No, I'm going to be honest, I didn't. I remember it was supposed to come out in August. I guess it is August 13th, so
it'll,
that makes sense, I guess. I didn't know it was out already, but I probably should have.
I saw it when I was watching Suicide Squad, so I was like, "Oh, Titans are out!" But I'm not going to throw it onto the schedule for a few weeks just because we've got a bunch of shows we're watching already. I mean, Superman and Lois is back, and we got Stargirl starting, and we have DC Legends still, and we're finishing up Sweet Tooth, so we'll get into Titans, but it'll be a few weeks because we're going to wrap up. Superman and Lois are supposed to be wrapping up in the next 2 weeks. And then Sweet Tooth, I think we're almost done with that. We might have 3 episodes left of that. I can't remember off the top of my head. But a lot of shows right now. All right, well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
Welcome to Dr. Geek's Laboratory.
Dr. Geek here with another reminder that the ESO Network is pro-science and pro-vaccine.
We urge you
to be a superhero and protect yourself, your family, and your fellow geeks around the world. Don't be fooled by the forces of evil and their anti-science misinformation campaign. Consult the latest CDC guidelines, your doctor, and get the COVID vaccine today.
And we're back. But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. For you.
All right, let's talk Justice League Infinity number 2. The issue opens up with more background on Amazo. We learn how he was created by Professor Arthur Ivo and how he was manipulated by Lex Luthor. Realizing his error, Amazo turned against Luthor and it fell to the League to protect Luthor. The Justice League soon discovered that what Amazo craved most was purpose and meaning. Dr. Fate helped Amazo with that search, and eventually Amazo became an ally in the process. After helping the Justice League with Solomon Grundy, Amazo's search sent him to space. 1 minute Superman is having dinner with Lois Lane, the next he's neck deep in a cauldron of hate. Superman was teleported to another world where Brainiac served a Nazi regime ruled by the great leader Vandal Savage. When a portal opened in the sky, Superman found himself with Doomsday, Metallo, and General Abraham Zod. The freedom fighters and apparently good guys on this alternate Earth. Meanwhile, on our Earth, Overman throws the dinner table demanding answers from the witch Lois Lane. Overman realizes he's on a new Earth and plans to conquer it. Lois pulls out a kryptonite gun, but it only seems to power up Overman. Overman battles the Justice League and is winning until Martian Manhunter shows up. John scans his mind and discovers that Overman landed on Earth and was raised by a fascist dictator, Vandal Savage. Overman fell in love with Lois Lane, who used her position to help the freedom fighters. When Overman discovered her betrayal, he hanged her himself. Martian Manhunter realizes something has changed when people start disappearing and other people are appearing, taking their place. Is the multiverse broken?
I don't know if the multiverse is broken, but the storytelling is definitely a little fractured, to say the least.
I can't argue with you there. There's a lot going on, and it's kind of bouncing all over the place, isn't it?
Yeah, it's frustrating because really none of it's bad. Like, I'm interested in the various parts of the story that are being told, but they don't really seem connected. I know that they will be at some point, but it's difficult to see the connection beyond something is happening with Amazo out in space, and whatever's happening with that is causing the other stuff. But we're spending so much time in the weeds of what's happening that I feel like we're losing track. I feel like it'd be better if we were focusing more on the cause first and fully explained that and then went with the ramifications. I don't know. It's one of the things, I'm sure it could work out, but at the moment it just seems overly confusing.
Yeah, I think part of that is me, if I was doing the story, I probably would have left the Amazo stuff out, or maybe just have little tidbits of it, and all that Martian Manhunter stuff that we had where he's off doing his own thing and then coming back to the team. I probably would have just had him come back to the team to see what was going on and cut out some of that Amazo stuff, especially what we had last issue. It's gargling the story too much.
The only thing I would counter is that I wouldn't take the Amazo stuff out is I think it's too central to what's actually going on. I know that we the readers don't know what that is yet exactly, but I'm fairly certain that that's there for a reason, because I think whatever is ultimately going on, he's very central to whatever the cause and resolution to this story is. So in that regard, I get why he's there. For what we understand of the story, I agree with you. He's not really adding much, but I think that's because the writer's not doing a good enough job connecting the pieces yet. What I think should have been cut really from this entire series so far is the entire Martian Manhunter backstory thing. I get what he's trying to do with it, where he was reluctant to come out of retirement and all that, but like at most have done that for one issue, but instead we keep getting this like dragging our feet with the Martian Manhunter stuff where we could be using that time to explain the action better.
Yeah, that's true. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Suicide Squad, Get Joker Number 1. Jason Todd is in Belrive when Amanda Waller comes to him to lead a mission for Task Force X. She wants him to kill the Joker. Red Hood's team consists of Firefly, Silver Banshee, some military guy named Pebbles, Meow Meow, Plastique, Wild Dog, Yonder Man, and Harley Quinn. Red Hood team is dropped off in Gotham, where they meet up with Toyman. Toyman leads them to a bar where Harley doesn't wait for the rest of the team. She walks in and puts a gun to Joker's head. She asks him what he is drinking, and the answer is a shot. Then a bunch of assassins point their guns at Harley. Red Hood walks in with the rest of the team and states, "Shots all around." Harley realizes it's not really the Joker, but still fires a shot in the guy's head anyways. The bar lights up with gunfire, and Yonder Man teleports Harley out of there, and the Suicide Squad retreats. When Red Hood realizes it's all a setup and calls Waller, not happy that she did not tell him the Joker was working for the Russians. The Joker shows up at Amanda Waller's apartment with her pizza, beats her with a crowbar, and steals the box. And the box I'm talking about is the one that blows off the heads of the Suicide Squad. And we see that at the end of the issue there, Joker kills the Firefly first.
This is a pretty good first issue, Drew. Obviously well-timed with the movie coming out. Not a coincidence, I'm sure. But I think Azzarello is a good writer to put on the Suicide Squad. I think it fits his, you know, his skill set and his tendencies with his writing. This was pretty good. Also, I like how he flipped kind of the story on its head by having the Joker gain control of the box, because I mean, it's not that the Suicide Squad hunting down the Joker isn't interesting, but it's not that unique, right? Like, it's not that weird of a thing for the Suicide Squad to do. And so having it kind of get flipped on its head here at the end, and now the Joker's got control of that, and how are they going to navigate and fix this situation is going to be really interesting.
It is. I mean, that I like the story, but I got really interested in when Joker got his hands on that box. It's like you said, it kind of flipped things around. The Suicide Squad, it's going to be hard for them to get the Joker when he's got that kill box right there. It'll be interesting to see what he does. All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week, Swamp Thing number 6. We're in the Kaziranga Forest in India. The Green is trying to put Swamp Thing back together again. Peacemaker and Task X Force are here trying to locate Swamp Thing or Levi Kami. A Prescott bioagent was released over 90 square miles of the forest, and its job is to impair the Green from communicating with himself. Heatwave is the first to find Swamp Thing. He tortures him, and Swamp Thing dives off a waterfall. At the end of the issue, we see that Swamp Thing is standing behind Mick.
I can't lie. It definitely still feels like an intrusion of the rest of the DC world into this story. To the writer's credit, he makes it work. And it is very interesting kind of seeing Suicide Squad pop on it. And what he also deserves credit for is that they feel like an intrusion intentionally in the story, right? Like, he's been doing his thing in the Green and kind of trying to figure out what's going on, and all of a sudden you get this, you know, group charging in trying to capture him. So I liked how the writer kind of did that, so that the kind of jarring that I felt having the DC universe kind of, you know, infiltrate this what had been a very self-contained story, it worked, because I think that's how it felt in the world too, to the character.
Yes. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the Suicide Squad was in this issue right when the movie released.
No, definitely not.
All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week, Crime Syndicate number 6. Owlman and Atomica defeated the Legion of Justice. Alexander Luthor was able to get his people into shuttles. In Metropolis, Ultraman is battling Ultra Girl, and Ultraman is trying to get Ultra Girl to join him. Ultra Girl does not like what Ultraman stands for and says she'd rather die than join him. Atomica shrinks, then goes inside Kara's head. Atomica kills Ultra Girl by walking on her brain. Superwoman tricked Jon Stewart and Sinestro into coming to Demon's Island. Superwoman gets free, then uses her lasso to cut off Jon Stewart's ring finger. Without the ring, Jon Stewart has clarity, and he chooses to kill Sinestro and join Superwoman. Atomica takes Lex Luthor prisoner. Atomica tells Luthor she will honor Johnny by making him her plaything and torturing him to death over the next few days.
this was fine, I guess. I never really have gotten over what I had hoped for this series, and it was, I don't know, a natural ending to the story, I guess. The crime syndicate becomes the crime syndicate. Okay. I don't know what else to add. It was fine.
My question is, are they going to do something after this? Are they done with the crime syndicate? Or are they going to do something else with them? Are we going to get another miniseries? Are we going to see them in the Justice League title, maybe? I don't know. There's a reason why they're telling the story. I'm just curious what it is. Or, you know, are they just going to be done?
I have to agree with you, Drew. I definitely agree with that, where it seems like it's leading into something. It's setting something up. I don't know what that is.
I don't either. And I hope they don't wait too long to get back to it, because people forget this story. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, but I mean, it wasn't a bad story.
I don't know that there's really anything to forget. I mean, ultimately, and this is kind of my problem with it, is it ultimately it's just the crime syndicate again. I mean, obviously minus Johnny Quick, so that's slightly different. And again, it's a John Stewart version of Power Ring instead of a Hal Jordan version. But it ultimately didn't really do it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know that this story needed, at no point did I feel like I was reading a story that needed to be told. I felt like I either knew this or I could have easily, you know, summarized. Like, if you'd asked me, like, how do you think this crime syndicate came to power? I probably would have come up with something like this. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I wanted there to be like a reason for the story, and I personally never felt like I got it. Yeah, I guess you can say it was to set up the origin, but did we need the origin? We have had loose versions of the origin before, and this really doesn't do anything, in my opinion, different enough to justify a retelling.
Yeah, and I can't really argue with you on that. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Batman 111. The Magistrate is going after the Uninsanity Collective, and Batman, Ghostmaker, and Harley show up and fight back against the Magistrate. Some of the kids from the Insanity Collective have been shot and need medical attention. Batman and the others retreat to the Ghost Stream, which is Ghostmaker's plane. Mayor Nakano addresses the people of Gotham City, letting them know that the Magistrate have apprehended members of the terrorist group known as the Insanity Collective. The Magistrate has also determined the location of Scarecrow, based on intelligence they've retrieved from his allies. Finally, the mayor announces that Batman has been fighting alongside the Scarecrow's forces of terror. Effective immediately, the mayor is expanding the authority of the Magistrate to dismantle all costume crime and vigilantism in Gotham. Batman has put a tracker on Peacekeeper 1, and he's going after the Scarecrow. Saint Simon is talking with Scarecrow about their victory. Scarecrow tells Simon that he is not going to allow him to de-escalate when the city is in a state of fear. That only happens during wartime. Simon tells Peacekeeper 1 to arrest Scarecrow, but Scarecrow hits Peacekeeper 1 with the highest dose of fear toxin he has ever given to a human. And then we see that at the end of the issue that Scarecrow captures Batman. I don't know about you, Cletus, but when we got towards the end of this issue, to me it felt like we were deviating from the future state storyline, with the Magistrate, or with the Peacekeeper 1 getting hit by Scarecrow's gas, and Scarecrow not wanting to comply with what the Magistrate wanted.
Oh, yeah, I have to agree with you, Drew. That felt like the moment of deviation, so to speak, was when Scarecrow turns around and gases Peacekeeper 1. That felt like, and this is how it becomes different, which I guess, I don't know. It's interesting. It's not, I guess, that surprising, because Tinian, I feel like, has been hinting strongly that Scarecrow really is the villain of this story, but it just feel like it's been so undercut by what we, you know, we read in Future State. And I know we keep getting the bookend where, like, the beginning is focusing on Scarecrow, but then the rest of the story seemed to continually downplay what Scarecrow was actually doing. And so then to kind of swing back and be like, nope, Scarecrow really is the big difference. Like, he's more of a villain than we thought. I don't know. I guess it works.
I don't know. I didn't like any of that Scarecrow stuff we had at the beginning of every issue with Batman.
No, I mean, I didn't either. And it didn't really work. I don't feel like... I'm not convinced that this Scarecrow is really any different other than you're just telling me that he is. But I feel like that's every Scarecrow story or every Riddler story or every Joker story. Like, oh, but this time he's serious. But then he's not because Batman wins. You know what I mean, Drew? Like, I'm not like...
I know what you mean. He's been hyping up Scarecrow to be bigger than he really is.
Which is, I feel like if I'm picking nits, I feel like this has been sort of my problem with Tinian's run as a whole, which has not been bad, to be clear. I don't think it's a bad run of Batman, but I've not liked it as much personally, because I feel like it's a lot of Tinian kind of trying to convince me that these characters are more important, that this storyline is more important than it is. And it's just rubbed me the wrong way, I guess. I don't know. It's not landed with me for the most part. Like the Joker War, it just felt overblown. Some of the other stuff we've gotten, it's just always has felt a little bit too much telling me that this thing is important and big and cool and this character is more dangerous than ever. And then instead of just showing it, instead of just doing it, I just feel like I'm constantly being told that this is the next big thing instead of actually just doing and writing it.
Exactly. I mean, we saw that with the Joker War. We saw that with Punchline, especially with Punchline, trying to make her keep telling us she's this over-the-top villain instead of just telling us a good story. All right, we also had a Ghostmaker backup story in this. We're at Devil Skull Island in the secret tunnels of Madame Midas. Ghostmaker is unconscious after the tunnels collapse on him. His suit gives him a cardiac assist, but Ghostmaker is still unresponsive. We get another assassin that tells Madame Midas of how Ghostmaker beat him by conquering the secret pain of death. And we see that this is to be concluded in Batman Annual Number 1, which is on sale November 20th. And I got to tell you, I'm kind of happy about that. I'm tired of these over-the-top Ghostmaker stories.
I mean, this is yet another great example of exactly what we're talking about with this Tinian run, is that this story is literally just a monument to why you should think that Ghostmaker is super cool. And, like, I do think the character is fairly cool, but you know what's a great way to make me think that less is constantly telling me that I should think it. Just let the character speak for itself for once. Like, this just constant over the top. It just... I don't know. It just doesn't work for me.
All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week. Green Lantern number 5. New Corriger. Sinestro was in bed with two sleeping alien women. Or at least I think they're both women. Sinestro hears or sees a ruckus out his window and gets dressed. Teen Lantern is fighting against some ships and winds. Next, some of the best Yellow Lanterns show up, like Arkillo. Teen Lantern creates constructs that look like lanterns she's met to battle the Yellow Lanterns. Teen Lantern creates a big explosion of green energy that takes out the Yellow Lanterns as well as herself. When Teen Lantern picks herself off the ground, she shouts Sinestro's name and creates a giant green John Stewart. A Yellow Lantern in a hood appears, and she places her hand around Teen Lantern's head and zaps her brain. Teen Lantern falls unconscious. A Green Lantern in a suit of armor shows up, let's just call him Iron Lantern, and states that the United Planets jurisdiction has been invoked. He tells the Yellow Lantern to back away. The Yellow Lantern is pissed and creates a giant snake to hold off Iron Lantern. The Yellow Lantern tells Iron Lantern that she's a nuclear bomb, and you let her off her leash with zero psi training. You're lucky my ring could trick her brain into shutting down. Now take her and get out of here. We do not want Sinestro coming down here. Then she calls him Simon, and she disappears before Simon can ask her any more questions. In the second part of the story, John Stewart evacuates the planet he's been trapped on for the last year. They travel to the Green Lantern base, where John reunites with the other Green Lanterns that are left. An incoming transmission from Kilowog requests evac from any lantern with a working ring. And I'm glad this issue finally answered the question of whether Jessica was going to become a Yellow Lantern or not. Because even though they didn't come right out and tell us, we both knew it was Jessica.
She's awfully good at using that yellow ring that she literally just obtained.
She is.
This was interesting. I am interested in the actual Green Lantern, Yellow Lantern part of the story, as we've talked about for, reviewing this series so far. I get a little frustrated when I feel like, again, this is, tying into what we just talked about with the Tinian stuff. I get frustrated sometimes when it feels like writers are trying to cram a character down my throat by showing how powerful they are. It's not that I don't believe that Teen Lantern can be that powerful. Sure, I guess, but we've not really seen her do a whole lot, Drew. And then she just goes and like takes down the entire Yellow Lantern Corps on her own. A hard pill to swallow.
It is. That was one of the things I was going to bring up, too. I mean, all those experienced Yellow Lanterns we've seen for quite a while, and Teen Lantern takes them all out, I had to roll my eyes at that.
And they make a point, and the thing that's frustrating to me is that they make a point to like say that it's the Elite Squad. If you've read a lot of the John's run of Green Lantern, if you've read the Sinestro run by Colin Bunn, you would recognize some of those guys too. So like those are recognizable, strong Yellow Lanterns, right? It's not just guys that they came up with. I mean, honestly, based on the way they, I don't know for sure because, it's not a real story, but based on the way they were portraying the story, it felt like if Sinestro himself popped out in that fight, that would not have made a difference. That was like, she knows fear, so, no Yellow Lantern could possibly beat her because she's actually experienced fear in her life. And I was like, what? Are we just saying that if you've been afraid in your life that you can't get beat by Yellow Lanterns now? I don't know how to tell you this, Drew, but there's a number of Green Lantern stories that don't make sense anymore.
Yeah, I have to say that the Teen Lantern thing was a little over the top.
Again, I don't mind her being strong. That's fine. And I honestly don't mind if at some point she did that, but I need you to warm me up to that. I can't have one of the very first things she does is just like her opening move is to just wipe the Yellow Lanterns like it's nothing. Where does she go from there, Drew? That's the problem. If that's the floor, if that's your entry, what's the ceiling? Ridiculous.
Yes, ridiculous. Now, I did get the feeling that Jessica Cruz is there undercover. At least that's what it felt like to me. She definitely didn't want Sinestro knowing she was there.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's understandable, right?
Yeah, it is understandable. But it definitely felt like Jessica Cruz is just hiding there, waiting for something to happen to make her move or whatever her plan is. I think her plan is to keep hidden for now, and she knows that the Green Lanterns don't have power right now, so she's going to hide out as a Yellow Lantern for how long, I don't know. At some point, I see her joining up with Joe and some of the others and doing whatever they're going to end up doing.
I'm definitely curious to see more of Yellow Lantern Jessica Cruz.
Me too, because I'm interested in what she's going to be doing. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Justice League number 66. The Justice League recovers after Simnar Utopica rammed into the Hall of Justice. Outside Oliver Queen's villa, Dinah and Oliver recover from being shot by non-lethal projectiles. Both Lois Lane's brother and fake Deathstroke are gone. Dinah calls Lois Lane and learns that the Hall of Justice has fallen. Queen Hippolyta tries to take out Simnar and fails. Simnar calls his girlfriend, who is not happy that Simnar went to Earth. Simnar plans to offer Earth's resources in exchange for his place in the Utopica restored, since past paid for. Black Adam battles Simnar, but only seems to power up the villain more. Lots and lots of reserve Justice League members show up along with the United Order. Superman tells Simnar he can stop right now or we'll do it for you. I got a question for you, Cletus, because I don't know. I felt a little more like Simnar is like overpowered compared to what he should be or what we'd seen in the past when he battled Superman before. Did you get that feeling?
Yeah, he's definitely stronger than the last time Bendis had him in the Superman book, and I think that's intentional. But I agree. I don't know that we've had it. The explanation for that doesn't fully make sense.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I know they did show that whatever Black Adam did to him just powered him up more, but they haven't really gave us an explanation why or whatnot. And it felt a little over the top that we need to bring in the whole Justice League to... plus the United Order, to stop this guy. He's not... I didn't get the feeling that he was Doomsday. It does feel like we're getting to the end of this story, though. I have a feeling it's going to wrap up.
What is that story, though? Would be my question. I don't... You know what I mean? I guess... I mean, obviously, Simnar attacking, but, like, what are we doing?
I think what they're doing is, you know, Simnar was supposed to go to trial... he got away trying to get back in the Utopica or something. I don't know. It's weird how, because they didn't explain it either when he talked to his girlfriend about offering Earth up, because that didn't make any sense to me.
I think he's theoretically offering it up as a like extension of the Simnar Empire, but that motivation doesn't even totally make sense. I know, I guess maybe that's the point, because they're trying to show, Bendis is trying to show how, like, broken he's become. But, like, that empire wasn't interested in expanding more. They wanted to remain somewhat insulated. At least that was the portrayal that we got.
Yeah, so it didn't really make sense, did it?
No.
All right, well, let's move on to the Justice League Dark story. Gotham City, Radnor Sin is freed from the prison of his mind. He knows what Merlin is after, an ancient and terrible power. In Atlantis, Merlin is battling the Justice League Dark and Aquaman. The dome is broken and the city of Atlantis has been breached. In the chaos, Merlin makes his way to the old Atlan Templus, and John Constantine is waiting there. Merlin states, beneath the drowned city, the dark world lies, dreaming. And it seems like Merlin wants to awaken some ancient, evil empire city. I don't know what it is. But something he wants to unleash onto the world.
I continue to be very into this story, Drew. It's really good stuff.
It is. And I found it interesting how they brought in Atlantis into the story too, especially with it being, you know, being an older race and an older city. So
it made and magical focus. I agree. Like all of it just sort of made sense.
Yeah. And I know you and I both wish we got this title by itself with, you know, more of a longer story, but,
I'll take this over getting nothing, though. Like, if the option was the series getting canceled or becoming a backup, I'll take the backup.
Agreed. All right, well, that wraps our comic book talk up for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk Sweet Tooth.
Okay, promo for the Flopcast. Let's go.
First, I need an adjective.
Naked.
Need a noun.
Wombat.
Place.
Woonsocket, Rhode Island.
Number.
251.
Okay then, the Flopcast is a naked podcast about cartoons, music, comics, movies, and wombats. Find us on the ESO Network and flopcast.net. Go ahead and listen to it in Woonsocket, Rhode Island, 251 times.
And we're back. Let's talk Sweet Tooth, Season 1, Episode 5, What's in the Freezer? General Abbott pays a visit to Dr. Bell, who we find out has been faking a terminus illness. The general asks where the book is, and Dr. Bell states she left it with Dr. Singh, her replacement. Dr. Bell states that the hybrids will be around a long time after humans are gone, and the general sends in one of his men to deal with Dr. Bell. Jeopard thanks Sweet Tooth for having his back with the kids in the last episode. Jeopard tells Sweet Tooth he is going to come with him to Colorado. Sweet Tooth and Jeopard come across Bear, who has a piece of paper with Gus's mother's address on it. Bear tells them she's going to hop on a train, and Gus wants to go with her. Bear leads Sweet Tooth and Jeopard to the Valley of Sorrows. It is a place where the sick were buried when they died and purple flowers grew. Humans fear these flowers, and when Bear and Jeopard argue, Gus tries to cross a rickety old bridge. Gus falls through the bridge and lands into the flowers. Dr. Singh is trying to get purple flowers out of his lawn. Bob stops by with a missing persons flyer for Nancy. No one has seen her for 3 days, and when Singh shows his wife the flyer, they get a call to come to the clinic over the radio. When Dr. Singh and his wife get to the clinic, they find a note that states they are out of hybrids. The community has discovered Nancy in the freezer at the clinic and confronts Dr. Singh. And when Dr. Singh's wife starts coughing, they burn the clinic as well as their home with both the doctor and his wife inside. We see the general and his people show up at Dr. Singh's house and puts out the fire. At the preserve, we see that it's been marked with pink ribbons. So it's been found. And then, of course, Gus gets rescued from the flowers by Jeopard and Bear, who use that parachute to cover themselves up so they don't touch the flowers. And looks like they're off to get on the train.
Drew, one thing I found really interesting in this episode was, I guess I had been kind of assuming that the Sings were in the past, and I know it was super unclear, I think intentionally, where, you know, timeline wise some of the different story arcs we were seeing were taking place, but it seems like it's happening concurrently to Sweet Tooth's story, so that was an interesting surprise to me, because I'm not sure that's what I expected.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting the general to come find Dr. Singh. Apparently, I wonder if he was working with the other doctor before.
That's definitely what was implied.
And she was doing stuff, you know, I mean, when we first were introduced to her and stuff, and we found out she was doing stuff to the hybrids, I just assumed she was doing it on her own. She may have been doing it under duress from the general.
Or it may not have initially been under duress. It may have been something where she eventually, it seems like she grew a conscience, is what it kind of seemed like to me, Drew. The implication in that confrontation between the two, it's heavily implied that she's not actually terminally ill. Obviously, she is by the end of the confrontation. But it felt implied to me like she had kind of like grown a conscience, or had like the grill had become large enough that she had to step away. But I was unconvinced that it wasn't at least initially voluntary.
The preserve part of the story, it felt like this has not been congruent with what's been going on with Gus, because
it has to be taking at least partly beforehand.
Yeah, because now we saw in this episode there's more animals there. So,
well, and we had seen the dad sees a flyer for the preserve fairly early in the first episode. So we know that last episode we saw the idea for the preserve start. But then not only that, like, time had to pass enough for those pamphlets to go out for the dad to see. And then obviously time has passed within what we've seen of just the preserve. But then also
you know, time from when the dad found that preserve to the present of Sweet Tooth story, that's several years in between those.
Yeah, so definitely time has passed on that. We were seeing the past before. So I'm really enjoying this, and I know we're starting to get towards, you know, we're halfway through or more now. So I'm very curious to see what's going to happen next, especially what's going on. I'm interested in seeing what's going on with Gus's mother. If she's still alive, is she dead? What's the whole backstory with that? I'm very interested in that.
The other thing that I am curious to see, Drew, is the flowers. I am very, like, you know that that's something else. Like, we're not done with that either. So I'm really curious to find out more about those, because we got the tease of them popping up in the lawns and that being a bad thing last episode. And then we see in this one, clearly they're dangerous. It's one of those like tiny details that I'm really intrigued by, and I'm curious to see what's to find out more information with those.
I'm curious about those too. We see them keep popping up with stuff that has to do with the virus. I've been wondering, are these flowers actually dangerous, or is it just people thinking that they're dangerous? And there might be another reason why they're popping up. I'm curious, are they tied to the virus? Are they tied to the hybrids? Are they tied to both? Tied to neither?
Are they tied to the cure? Like, that would be, that's something I've wondered.
That would be interesting too. Could be tied to the cure. Maybe these flowers have something to do with eradicating the virus, and that's why they keep popping up where the virus is at. It's very interesting. I'm very curious about what's going on with these flowers.
For the past 12 seasons, Mike and Mike have been bringing you a weekly look at all things geek, with reviews, discussions, interviews, and topicals from across the geekosphere. Now, with geek life slowly returning to normal in 2021, join the Earth Station One crew as we look at the return of the summer movie season, preview the fall TV lineup, look at all the big conventions now happening, along with other geek topics. You can listen to Earth Station One wherever fine podcasts are found, and as always, Earth Station One is a founding member of the ESO Network.
All right, let's move on to our main topic for this episode, the Suicide Squad movie. We have a few guests joining us tonight. Our first guest is coming all the way from Chicken Town. Let's welcome back Kevin Eldridge.
Hey, guys. Great to be back on Earth Station DCU. I feel like I think last time we spoke was for Wonder Woman, and now here we are. It's another DC movie. So good to be back.
Good to have you back on. Also joining us tonight, from his airlock away from home, the award-winning Bobby Nash.
Hey, I kind of like the idea of us being jesters. it kind of fits with this movie.
All right, the Suicide Squad movie. The government sends the most dangerous supervillains in the world, Bloodsport, Peacemaker, King Shark, Harley Quinn, and others, to the remote enemy-infused island of Corto Maltese. Armed with high-tech weapons, they trek through the dangerous jungle on a search and destroy mission with only Colonel Rick Flagg on the ground to make them behave. Alright, the first thing I want to ask you guys, is the Suicide Squad movie a sequel?
Yes.
Yeah, I have to say yes.
Yes, because we have returning characters and relationships that were built in that first movie carry over with a couple of our returning characters.
Yeah, like Harley and Rick Flagg know each other.
Right? Yes, most notably.
Yeah, so there was very little reference to the first movie. So they're kind of like, yeah, that happened first, but we're not really going to dwell on it. Although I think having just adding the to the title and having the same title other than that is a little weird and confusing. I'm not crazy about that.
Right. I think that it's important to have those three characters returning. Obviously, Harley is very popular, and Margot Robbie is wonderful as her. So her being there is a no-brainer. I think Rick Flagg gives it that continuity of, you know, he was the guy to lead them. And Viola Davis as Amanda Waller is just too good not to be in the movie.
Yeah.
Although, you know, when we get to, I'm sure we'll get to it later, but there was some great stuff with her, and I'm surprised that the end scene was not her surrounded by an office full of dead people.
Yeah, that crossed my mind too.
I think the R rating on this movie had a major impact on it. Do you think this movie would have worked with a PG-13 rating? Or do you think it would have hurt the movie?
I think it would have been a different movie.
Yeah, they could have done it.
Yeah.
And maybe it would have been better. Maybe it would have been, you know, I mean, we've seen James Gunn do Guardians of the Galaxy movies, which are, you know, great and they're super fun. So would it have been closer to Guardians if he was kind of reining it in a little bit and not going for so much blood and gore? Maybe.
Yeah, I think it could have worked, but I also get what they were going for.
Yeah.
You know, these are bad people. You know, so like if they made it a point for them not to go around killing people, that kind of takes away some of the fact that these are bad guys.
I think the movie would be different, obviously, with Gunn at the helm anyway. But I feel like we've seen what Suicide Squad looks like as a PG-13 movie, and it's not as good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, there's other stuff that, you know, that's not the only part of that picture, but we've kind of seen it, and it didn't. I don't think it worked as well as a PG-13 movie because they didn't feel like villains that much.
Right.
Boomerang was really one of the only guys that felt like a turd in the first movie.
So the first movie was PG-13 because I was trying to remember.
Unless my memory's wrong, I'll look, double check.
I can't think of much.
I already double checked. It was PG-13.
Was okay. Yes, obviously they made the movie they wanted to make, and it's there's a calculus involved, I'm sure, is that, you know, well, you're going to limit your audience in that it's not family friendly. It's not going to be bring the kids to see a DC Comics movie, but it doesn't have to be that, you know,
but with HBO Max releasing it the same day, you now have a way around that.
Yeah, I have to say that is, I think they're limited less by the R rating because of that.
Well, sure, it's easier than ever for kids to see R-rated movies. Don't have to sneak into the theater the way we used to, right?
Right, yeah.
I thought it was interesting that chose the Corto Maltese. You know, with it being a fictional island, this was the place was actually originally appeared in Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns. And I actually remembered it from the Batman 89 movie.
That is correct as well, yes. That's where Vicki Vale had just returned from.
Yes. Huh. And, of course, it's also been mentioned in Arrow, too. Mm-hmm. So we've seen it quite a bit of places. But I thought it was interesting they chose that island where they were going. So.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was a nice way to be in the same vein as the, you know, the most famous version of the comic Suicide Squad, the original, you know, 80s run, where they are this felt more like them acting as a black ops government thing, right? Like, obviously, technically, that's what they're doing in the first one, but you know, I don't know. I think Suicide Squad loses something a little bit when it's domestic missions. I feel like it feels like more what was intended, you know, when they're going out and sort of doing the dirty work the government doesn't want people to know.
Right, because the mission they undertook in the first movie could have been handled by anybody.
Yeah.
That could have been handled by the Justice League or anybody. This plot, especially, you know, I'm assuming we're in spoiler territory here, right? It's okay to spoil things?
Oh, yeah, we've already played the spoiler song, so we're good.
Okay, so, you know, especially the fact that she sends in a team basically as cannon fodder to distract the government of Corto Maltese while the real team sneaks in on the other side of the island. You know, that feels like a Suicide Squad mission. Amanda Waller is like, yeah, kill these people. They're okay.
Yeah, I agree with that. And then on to add on to that, I thought the first movie also ultimately was an objectively heroic mission. Like they were trying to save the world, right? And then this one, it's pitched that way, but we eventually learn that really it's just to cover up an American secret. They don't actually have to save the day. That's not actually the goal of the mission. And again, that's a Suicide Squad mission. Like that, you know, that, you know, covering up a dirty secret. They happen to save the day, but that is not the goal.
Right. And they do it against orders at the end. They're told to leave.
Yep.
You know, just let Starro destroy the place.
Yeah, I have to say, I did enjoy Amanda Waller getting whacked with the golf club. Mm-hmm.
Again, that's why I said I'm surprised that we got this scene with her with like the ice pack on her head, and she looks over and everybody's still alive and doing their jobs, because the Amanda Waller I know from the comics would have killed them all.
Yeah, it was weird to. I was thinking, well, how can they go on after that? Like either Amanda's got to go or that whole rest of the team's got to go. So it was surprising to see that scene where they're in like adjoining rooms, you know, looking at each other through a window. Like, how is this even happening after just whacking her and knocking her out like that? And the way they sort of tried to explain it was, well, their punishment is they have to go work with Peacemaker now, which, okay, like they're selling the premise, you know, theoretically of the spinoff series that's coming. So, okay. I don't know that it quite makes sense as far as would Amanda really let them get off that easy.
I wonder if we will, for the movie, I agree that there's not as much payoff as I would have expected, but I do wonder if we'll see more of a payoff in the show. Obviously that's speculation, but it wouldn't shock me if part of whatever ultimately happens in that show is seeing Waller get, you know, the true comeuppance that she was aiming for.
I wouldn't be surprised, especially with James Gunn writing the television series. So yeah,
exactly. So we know we have the same creative mind and process going into the show. So I think there's a greater chance that those threads get brought over than if somebody new is taking over.
Yeah. And I'm speaking of Peacemaker. I'm not as familiar. I know who John Cena is, but I'm not a wrestling guy, so I don't know him from that. I know he's a wrestler, but I've not seen a lot of his movies. So this is really the first time I've really seen him act. And I was pleasantly surprised by how good he was in the role.
Yeah, I'm with you, Bobby, in that I stopped watching wrestling like 30 years ago. So I know the name, and I know he was a wrestler. And I saw him in, I believe he was in a Amy Schumer's movie, Trainwreck. So he did a comedy role before and was good in that, if I'm remembering correctly. So this is maybe the second time I've seen him.
Yeah.
I think this is something that plays to his strengths. I think one of his most, like, well-regarded film appearances before this was the Trainwreck movie. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the few times they've let him really flex his comedic chops. Mm-hmm. And then we see that again in this one. And obviously, you know, the guy can do action sequences. That's not shocking.
Right.
But instead of just making him be like straight-laced and serious, I mean, they kind of lean into, I think it's hard sometimes for movies to get around the fact that he's John Cena. And I thought that by letting him lean into the comedy stuff, I feel like it works. Like, you know, it's John Cena, and that's kind of funny, and it works because he is kind of funny in what he's doing.
Right. This is the same guy that the only thing I knew him from, really, is those commercials where he's riding a cow. So, but I do love the fact, too, that in all of the press for the movie, that he is going to, like, talk shows. Not as John Cena. He's going in the Peacemaker garb. I don't know if you guys have seen any of that.
I've heard that, but yes. I've not seen any of it.
I'm going to have to look that up now. Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, he and Margot Robbie and James Gunn were on Jimmy Kimmel, and he was there as he's there in the Peacemaker getup. And at the red carpet when they had the premiere, he showed up in the Peacemaker outfit.
Yeah, I mean, that helmet looks so comfortable. Why would you ever want to take it off?
I got to tell you guys that I told Cletus this last week, but I was surprised when I saw that the Suicide Squad movie was coming out, because I didn't see... I must have been hiding under a rock or something, because I don't remember seeing any trailers for it. I knew it was coming out soon, but I didn't realize it was coming out as soon as it did. I just happened to be on HBO Max, and it said it was releasing at 7 p.m. I was like, it's releasing at 7 p.m.? And Cletus was telling me he'd been watching the Olympics and saw tons of commercials. Well, I don't watch live TV that much. I usually watch Netflix or Hulu or HBO Max or CW, you know, something like that. And I really hadn't seen any commercials for it. So I went into the movie not knowing what to expect, and I was pleasantly surprised.
I did see some on the CW during like some of the DC shows, but they weren't just trailers. They were commercials where like actors from the Suicide Squad would say something about the show they're on, that the commercial was airing during. Like there was one where Nathan Fillion is on there, and he's like, it was shown during Legends of Tomorrow. And he's like, well, Legends, you guys are good at this. Here's what the Suicide Squad's good at. And then it goes into like a little tiny, like a teaser trailer.
Now, was this in the past couple weeks or?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, because I'm trying to think. Cletus and I think some of the CW shows have been on hiatus for the last few weeks.
Right.
So
right. Well, it was right before those, yeah, you know. But, you know, the last time they were on new before it dropped. So, what, 2-3 weeks ago maybe?
Okay, see, we watch all those shows. I don't remember seeing any Suicide Squad commercials.
I definitely saw at least a couple. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's just because we're watching on different platforms or what, but I saw a number during the Olympics. I felt like they did go hard in the advertising campaign there, but I've definitely seen a few. Like on YouTube, there have been, like, you know, the ads that you get. I've seen clips there. I've seen some during commercials for the CW shows that we watch. So I don't know. I don't know necessarily that they went huge on the advertising. I feel like you just missed it, Drew.
That's possible. So,
I'm like Drew. I didn't see any of the trailers, commercials, nothing. But I just actively avoid that stuff. I don't want to see anything in advance. So I was going into this knowing essentially nothing about it, and which I thought was especially effective for this movie, though, in that the misdirect of the team. That's just the distraction at the beginning. You know, I didn't know what the main lineup was supposed to be. So that completely worked on me.
Having Rick and Harley in that first group made you think they would mostly be successful.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a very effective kind of misdirect. I thought that was,
and Boomerang. That was the one that got me. It was the three returning members, and Boomerang in particular, I feel like, he definitely is a mainstay in the Suicide Squad comics, but I feel like one of the things that, like, to me characterizes his appearances is his ability to survive. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, yes, he throws boomerangs, obviously, but I feel like there's always been sort of like one of the interesting characteristics that they show in that is that, yeah, the dude just throws boomerangs, but he's always the one coming out of these missions alive, you know, despite all these other people with all these other powers. And so when he was the second dude to go down, I was like, what? that surprised me.
Yeah. The biggest thing that was ruined for me in some of the commercials and trailers was the reveal of Starro.
Oh, I wish I had known that was going to be the villain.
I did not know Starro was going to be the villain, but I figured it out when I was watching the movie and they mentioned the what was it, the Star Program or Starfish?
Starfish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Now, I geeked out over Starro.
Yeah.
And the people with the starfishes on their face, because, I mean, I remember those comics where you saw the cover. There's a great Justice League cover Brian Boland drew.
Oh, yeah.
Where they're all just standing there and, like, Superman, Wonder Woman, all of them with starfishes over their faces.
Yeah. I mean, it's so ridiculous. You know, what is sillier than a giant starfish from outer space? And yet that's so super creepy when the little ones will cover faces. And yeah, that Boland cover is so iconic and scary, you know, very effective. And I thought in the movie, it was a mix of that. When all the little ones, thousands of the face-sized starfish come shooting out and are clamping onto people's heads. That was so scary and creepy. But they also went full kaiju with the giant stomping around Starro looked goofy, you know, which I thought was fine. You know, it should look goofy. It's a giant starfish.
Yeah. All of them talking with one voice was very creepy as well.
Yeah.
I wish they'd have stuck with that through when the whole city was, you know, because they are the, like the general just talks. But, you know, when they're in that room and they all start talking with one voice, that's very creepy.
I thought they struck a good balance because I like that they didn't try to go like full Snyder super serious on Starro and try and convince you that Starro is a completely serious, scary villain. Yeah. It's like you guys are right. Like there are certain parts, aspects of the character that are legitimately scary and intimidating, but he's also a starfish. And I
Yeah, you better lean into how the movie got that balance well.
Like they got the seriousness of the threat, but they're also like, but it's also like a Technicolor starfish.
I think the movie, I think they did a good job of balancing the seriousness and the humor in this movie. There was a lot of humor in this movie. And some of it was subtle and some of it was outright ridiculous. But, oh man, it had me laughing a lot of the movie.
Well, it certainly helps when you write the film to be funny instead of trying to edit an already shot film and trying to force the edits to be funny. It's amazing how much better that works.
Well, I gotta say, too, I think they cast the movie very well. Oh, yeah. And I can't pronounce his last name, Desmoclian, the guy that was Polka Dot Man. In the hands of a different actor, that character might not have worked. I thought he pulled that off. Obviously, Margot Robbie is perfect as Harley Quinn, you know, and Sylvester Stallone as King Shark. These things are perfect. I mean, Idris Elba is always brings the goods. You know, John Cena as Peacemaker, even though it's not any Peacemaker I've ever read in a comic, he is so good in that role, and it's believable. You believe, you know. You understand why he's there based on the character they created for the movie. And I think so having all of those people in the right place, I think worked. Certainly Peter Capaldi. Oh my God, is so good. You know, he's good in everything he does, but seeing him here, that was one of the big surprises because all the trailers made it look like he was part of the Suicide Squad.
Oh.
And you know, he's not.
He's still a villain though.
Yeah, well, that's true. Well, yeah. Well, in villains. A movie with no heroes. Yeah,
he's still managed to rise. Yeah. About Peacemaker, though, is that Peacemaker was more of a hero character originally, wasn't he? I think.
Yeah.
I mean, that goes back to one of the Charlton characters. Yeah.
He was a straight laced, you know. He was a Captain America kind of hero.
Yeah, yeah. What's interesting, I think, with
Peacemakers, I feel like not just even a couple of years ago. I feel like he was probably most famous for being the inspiration for the comedian.
Right.
And we're in the middle. I don't even know if I would call it a Peacemaker Renaissance, but like the golden age for that character. Because DC's going all in on this guy. He's the current in the comics. He's the current leader of the Suicide Squad. Obviously, we know he's getting his own show spinoff out of this movie. And they're pushing him hard in the comics right now. Like anytime the Suicide Squad's popping up, it's Peacemaker. So it's very interesting. I'm curious to see the kind of, I feel like we're kind of rewriting this character's legacy a little bit as a comic character.
Well, I think too, just like with Guardians, James Gunn is taking these characters that are older and not as popular. They're like, I don't think I'd call any of these characters like an A-list. They're, you know, none of them are Superman or Batman.
But it allows him
to take more creative liberties with it, just like with Guardians. I mean, the Guardians of the Galaxy is made up of characters mostly from the 60s, many of whom are quite different than their comic counterparts in the movie. And some of that happens here, but because they're obscure characters, most of the audience doesn't know that that's not always been that guy, you know.
They did a good job of giving these characters nuance too. Speaking of Polka Dot Man, you know, his mother issues. they didn't have to go into any flashback of it with her, you know, just popping up you know, him seeing everything as his mother, let us know that there was mother issues.
Right.
That visual gag was just so smart. I mean, it just, it's one thing to like make the joke, just picture them as your mom and then see him do a violent thing. Like we've seen something like that, but I feel like we've rarely seen him actually, we actually see him picturing the mom and how absurd that would actually look. Oh, it killed me every time. It just kept getting funnier.
Especially when she's Starro. Oh.
And at the same time, that was Polka Dot Man was, you know, among the more ridiculous looking of the characters. You know, maybe King Shark would be his only rival in that category, but he was really such a tragic character. Like it seems ridiculous, polka dots. He throws polka dots at people. He gets the big spots pop up on his face. You know, it's just so silly visually, but he really sold that as just such a sad, you know, mentally ill character. It really got darker than most of the other ones.
Yeah. And the moment where he this look comes across his face right before he yells, "I'm a superhero." I knew he was about to die. It's like the minute he said it, I was like, there he goes. But I also like too the character of Bloodsport, how he, I'm not leading your team to at the end of it. He is their leader. And, you know, especially the relationship that he develops with Ratcatcher, you know, because we see the relationship he has with his own daughter.
Yeah.
And so the relationship he has with her is almost like another daughter, but a more loving relationship. He's not going to let her die.
Right. And I love the fact that he hated rats.
Yeah.
One of the things that I thought was super interesting in comparing this to the first Suicide Squad is obviously we know initially they cast Elba to just replace Will Smith as Deadshot, and then they changed their mind. Like, well, maybe we'll bring Will Smith back at some point or whatever. But you can see how much a difference casting makes. Will Smith is just too likable for me to ever fully buy him as a villain. It's not that I don't think he can do it as an actor. It's just like he's so Will Smith, and they wanted him to be Will Smith as Deadshot, and you just never fully bought him as the scumbag that we know Deadshot is in the comics. And I thought that was something that Elba was, you know, just much more apt to be able to do with his character of Bloodsport. Like, yes, ultimately we see him do the heroic thing in the end, but even that is, you know, he still uses it as blackmail for himself. They don't expose the story at the end because that's not what serves his needs. So like everything we get is, again, you can see what they wanted to do with the first one. They do it right the second time.
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely agree.
One of the things I found pretty funny was when they went to rescue Flag, you know, Amanda Waller told them that Flag had been captured and stuff. So they just go in guns ablaze and don't even question anything. Kill everybody in the camp, and when they find him, he's there, not a prisoner at all. They're just kind of like, tea. Oops.
I mean, those were her instructions. She said, kill everyone you see.
Yeah.
With extreme prejudice.
What I think is really smart about that scene, too, though, is that as the audience, I feel like we just assume that those are bad guys, too, right? Like, Gunn plays on our assumptions as movie viewers that, naturally dudes guarding a camp with guns are bad guys. And so I don't think most of us thought anything of it. Like, oh, of course they're going to kill those guys. They're bad guys.
Yeah, that was another very clever misdirect. That was a very effective surprise, I thought.
Plus, I mean, we're clearly shown a little later in the movie, too. Amanda Waller doesn't give a crap about anybody on that island.
No. No, it's literally just the hard drive.
Yeah, if she could have nuked the island and been done with it, she would have, but then she wouldn't have got what she needed. Yeah.
Speaking of, again, evolutions and improvements from the first to second movie, I thought Harley Quinn was a huge upgrade in terms of how they dealt with her character. Obviously, Robbie's fantastic again. That's not a surprise. But the way that they deal with her character, I don't think there's any better example of that than when she kills the dictator.
Yes.
I mean, that is, the ball is in her court so much more. The fact that she frees herself, she's not the princess in the castle that they go have to save. It was just, I thought Gunn just handled that character just so much better. I was very impressed.
Yeah, right. And it wasn't just her killing him because she's a villain. It was like, oh, you're going to kill kids.
Yep.
I've been in this relationship and I swore I would never do it again. And that's a big red flag. You know, I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah.
And then that she doesn't have to. Yeah. She frees herself. And, you know, the scene where they're like making all these big plans to come in and rescue her. And she's like, what are you guys doing?
That Harley sequence was one of the strongest parts of the movie. I think it was like a little Harley movie within the movie. And yeah, it had the shock of when she suddenly shoots him. It was very effective. And also just her as a character, that we don't want to see Harley being subservient to a monster again. You know, we've seen Harley in that position. That's her origin story, but she's moved beyond it. So that was fantastic to see her in this new kind of a role. But that whole sequence was just so wonderfully executed as far as her escape after when she's hanging on those chains, and the way she grabs the guy and attacks that guy, gets the key with her foot, and then that leads to that whole kind of acrobatic sequence of taking everybody out, making her escape. That was just wonderfully filmed. That was really a high point of it, I thought.
I also thought her reaction to finding out that Rick Flag was dead was quite good, she makes that, well, he was my friend, because this is someone who doesn't have, doesn't have friends. And so that they built that, because we see a little bit of that playful, friendship at the beginning when she shows up on the plane.
Yep.
But the fact that, his death seems to have actually emotionally, impacted her in some way.
And I think the movie pays that off too, not just with her saying that, but we see it, he goes out of his way to save her. Obviously, ultimately she didn't need that, right? But she notices that. Obviously, she doesn't need to verbalize it, but we see her see that Flag cares enough to go and rescue her. So I thought that, again, that, just speaking of how well structured this movie was, the movie, she doesn't just say that and it doesn't feel unearned. It makes sense even just within what we've seen in the movie.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Oop, I think we lost Drew.
No, you didn't. I'm trying to remember what I was going to talk about before Cletus started talking. I cannot.
Sorry, I didn't mean to derail you. I just...
although I remember what I wanted to bring up. It was Michael Rooker's character. Because at the beginning of the movie, we had him by himself bouncing that ball, and we see him kill that bird. And I thought it was kind of poetic that when he dies, we see that same type of bird come and start feeding on him. That was just one of the incidents in this movie where we saw things like that, where it came back around like that. And I really liked that.
Well, yeah, that was a nice touch. It was a goldfinch, I think.
Wow, I'm impressed. Yeah.
I could be totally wrong. That's
like okay. All I knew is it was a bird.
But yeah, I liked seeing that bird revenge, though. That was good. Because, that was what a nasty way to start the movie. Just watch a bird get squashed.
That brings up another point I wanted to bring up. Because with King Shark, one of the themes was about him not eating his friends. And we see him come across the aquarium with those fish-like things in there. And he's like, oh, these are my friends. And then when the glass breaks out, we find out that they're trying to eat them. So I found that humorous.
Yeah.
Oh, I was so pleasantly surprised when he didn't die from the fall. I was so sure he was dead, and I was mourning him because I loved his character so much. I wasn't shocked that he died because it's Suicide Squad. I'm prepared on some level for any of them to die, but I was like, no, not King Shark. And then he sort of lightly moved to cover himself from the bullets. I was like, yes, he's still alive.
They put a lot of bullets into him. I thought he was going to be a goner too. And
he clearly was on some level bulletproof or bullet resistant, which I was totally fine with because I loved King Shark and I did not want him to die.
Me too. I definitely want to see him in a sequel. One of my favorite scenes is in the movie is when he's holding up his hand and he gets called on. And he goes, "Hand?
Yeah.
Yes, that's your hand."
Yeah, that was, and the master of disguise bit was pretty funny.
Oh, the mustache was so good.
But I also love the bit too that, because I don't remember if it happened in the first movie, but was this the first time where we actually saw Amanda Waller kill one of them for not going through with the mission?
No, they kill Slipknot.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was so obvious that he was the one that was going to go in the lead up to that.
Gotcha.
Even if you like barely saw any, because like he was, I don't know. He was just, to me, I feel like there's always one character in the Suicide Squad lineup for whatever, like the Arrowverse version or whatever, where you can be like, that's the one that they're going to kill.
Gotcha. This is how important. I didn't even remember it. So, but it was smart too. But I think because it was Michael Rooker in this one, we didn't expect it. I didn't expect it to be him.
I didn't either.
I thought, and I was right in a sense. I thought, like, I was so sure Pete Davidson was going to be the head blown up character, and it was. It just wasn't by Waller.
Right.
Well, yeah, it ended up that whole team got wiped out essentially. So, but yeah, Rooker was the one that was actually taken out by Amanda Waller's explosive thing, which was kind of a surprise.
I just want to talk about that opening sequence as a whole. Just phenomenally executed. It sets up the concept of the Suicide Squad. If you didn't see the first movie, you don't know anything about it. It gets that done in like 5 minutes, and then you get the payoff for what, like, the Suicide Squad really is. It's a suicide mission. We see, again, it's a team of cannon fodder, and we don't realize it early on, but then as you're watching the movie and you kind of go back and think, when you think about the lineup that she sends there, like, of course that's the cannon fodder team.
Yeah, right. But they also do a good job of, we get to know those characters in that short bit of time.
Oh yeah,
when they're on that plane.
I love the banter on the airplane. Yes. Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that James Gunn does so well, is writing that sort of thing. You know,
that whole debate over the weasel. What is that thing? Is it a dog? And then Harley's so excited that maybe it's a werewolf. And I always wanted to meet a werewolf. I love that stuff.
I love the fact that at the end of the movie, we see the weasel get back. We think the weasel's dead the whole movie, and then it just gets up and walks away.
Nobody could check if he could swim.
I love that weasel. That was so funny. So fun to watch that creature just screeching and staggering around. Super fun. And yeah, it was fun to see him hop up at the end. But then I was also thinking, wait a minute, didn't they say that this thing like killed 27 children or something? So it's like, oh no.
The not and being able to
go gorge himself on starfish people.
Yep.
I was, one thing I was a little bit surprised, I've been so conditioned by Marvel films that I was a little surprised that we didn't get like some shot of a mini Starro in like a jar or something at the end. I was like, oh, I feel like we're definitely going to get one of those. And then we did. And I was like, oh, I am a little bit surprised by that.
Yeah.
Not a complaint necessarily. I feel like I've been so conditioned by all of the superhero movies we've seen that I was like, of course they're going to have some teaser. Like, he's still out there. Plus that we get Jaro from the current DC comics, which would be hilarious. I don't know if you guys have read that.
What's Jaro?
So it's really from the Scott Snyder run on Justice League. And then that kind of went into the death metal big event that he did. And Jaro was literally like a tiny Starro that essentially viewed Batman as his dad. and was on the on the Justice League's team and was like part of their part of the good guys. It was hilarious. Oh,
wow. Love Jaro. Anything else you guys want to say about Suicide Squad before we wrap this up?
I did love the small role that John Ostrander, who wrote the Suicide Squad comics, had.
Yep.
In the movie. It was great seeing him in there.
Yeah, that was when I saw that face. I was like, wait, who is that? That guy looks familiar.
I was happy that he was in it too, because this felt like a much better homage to the Ostrander
Suicide Squad than what the first movie was. This felt very true to what, like, I thought his vision in the comics was.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
All right, well, that wraps up our episode for this week. Do you have a shout-out, Kevin?
Well, sure. I would say, well, a couple of things. Well, maybe three things. I would say the latest, well, as this show comes out, maybe it was the previous weeks, but a recent episode of Earth Station 1, I was a guest on, and I was there to discuss Suicide Squad. So if you want to hear even more talk about this movie on the ESO Network with Mike and Mike and Ashley and Alex and me over on Earth Station 1, check that out. You can also find me here on ESO every week on my show, which is the Flopcast, where Cornflake and I just do a completely silly, goofy show every week. So check that out. And people who are going to be at Dragon Con Labor Day weekend, I am scheduled to be at Dragon Con, and my schedule has filled up with all kinds of very fun panels and presentations and stuff, several of which involve DC Comics subjects, including, I believe, Suicide Squad. So if you're going to be around Atlanta Labor Day weekend, look me up at Dragon Con.
I went to listen to that episode of Earth Station 1 today. It hadn't dropped yet. I was like, dang it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's probably coming out as we record. It's probably being released.
All right. Do you have a shout out, Bobby?
Yes. Well, actually, it's probably old news by the time this airs. But unfortunately, for the first time since 1989, I will not be at Dragon Con this year. We just had a family scheduling issue come up, and I had to cancel my appearance, and I am very bummed. So I'm going to live vicariously through Kevin and everybody else down there.
We're going to miss you, Bobby, but we're looking forward to we're going to come out swinging with Bobby Nash back on board for 2022.
Absolutely.
Better than ever.
I am looking forward to it. It's, I've done some virtual panels that'll air, you know, during the convention. So I guess kind of there, but I just won't be there physically. You know, just like I said, you know, things come up, you know, life happens. You know, it is exciting to be going back into cons. I've done a couple of small ones in the past month or so. So it's almost feels like we're getting kind of back to normal. We still got a ways to go, but But other than that, there's always new books and stuff. You can check me out at bobbynash.com or I'm author Bobby Nash on Facebook, at Bobby Nash on Twitter, and Bobby Nash Writes on Instagram. So please come and check them out.
All right. What's your shout out for this week, Cletus?
All right, Drew, you ready? I got a whole list here.
I'm ready.
So I mean, we talked about it in talking about the movie, but one of the things Gunn does obviously well in the Guardians series and in this Suicide Squad movie is all of the deep cut comic characters that he gets. So I went and made a list of the first appearance of every character that we got in the show. All right. So I'm going to start off, and Drew, I'll send this to you afterwards so you don't have to listen to it.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. All right. So Harley Quinn, I know most people probably know this. She originally appeared in the Batman, the Animated Series, specifically the episode Joker's Favor in 1992. Her first comic appearance was in Batman Harley Quinn, which came out in 1999. Bloodsport first appeared in Superman Volume 2, Number 4, 1987. King Shark first appeared in Superboy Volume 4, Number 0, in 1994. I actually was a little surprised by that. I thought he was a little older than that.
I think I have that comic.
Oh, wow. Polka Dot Man, unsurprisingly an old character, popped up in Detective Comics number 300 in 1962. Ratcatcher. Now, the character that we get in the movie is not technically a character in the comics, but is based on Ratcatcher Otis Flanagan, and he first appeared in Detective Comics 585 in 1988. Peacemaker, we talked about, not originally a DC character, but a Charlton Comics character, first appeared as a backup story in The Fight in Five, number 40, in 1966. Rick Flagg, the first Rick Flagg, appeared in Brave and the Bold, number 25, in 1959 on the Suicide Squadron, which was more of a war comic and not what the Suicide Squad is now. His son, Rick Flagg Jr., who is what the Rick Flagg that we're all familiar with in modern storytelling, what the character in the movie is based on, first appears in Legends number 1 in 1986, as does his boss, Amanda Waller, also appears in Legends number 1. Star of the Conqueror, very famously, Brave and the Bold, number 28, in 1960. The Thinker, and this actually, if you had asked me who the oldest character was, I think I probably would have picked Polka Dot Man. It's actually The Thinker. First appeared in All Flash, number 12, 1943. Although, yep, that's the DeVoe version, and the one that we get in this movie is very clearly based on a different Thinker who first appears in the New 52. In Suicide Squad Volume 4, number 25, in 2014. So an old character, but based on a much newer version of the character. Javelin first appears in Green Lantern Volume 2, number 173, in 1984. Captain Boomerang first appears in The Flash, number 117, in 1960. Mongal appears in Showcase 95, number 8, which, unsurprisingly, given the name, first appeared in 1995. Savant, this surprised me, is the newest character on the list. First appeared in Birds of Prey number 56 in 2003. TDK is not technically a character, but is very strongly based on Arm Fall Off Boy, who first appeared in Secret Origins number volume 2 number 46 in 1989.
Gee, I wonder why they changed that name.
I think they, you know, I actually think they changed it because they didn't want people to know that that's who it was.
Yeah.
I think they wanted it to think that it was somebody else. And even if you did like the abbreviation, like they did in the movie TDK, if you had done an abbreviation of Arm Fall Off Boy, I think enough people would have put together who he was.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, like, I mean, that name is very much in line with the humor of this movie. Blackguard. Drew, I'm very excited for this one. First appears in Booster Gold number 1 in 1986. And then finally, Weasel, who I was honestly not convinced was a real character, first appeared in Firestorm Volume 2, number 36 in 1985.
I also read where we get just a glimpse of one of the characters in prison. It's the woman with all the different colors.
There's also Calendar Man.
Calendar Man
is in the background too.
Yep. And I forget his name. The guy that Calendar Man's with is a fairly newer, like a one-shot character who was something with playing cards had been stuck to his face and get ripped off. So that's why he's missing patches of skin. But I forget her name too now. I should have wrote it down. But that character, there was an old comic way back when called Dial H for Hero, readers would send in characters, and the main characters would dial the Dial H dial and would become new characters. Most of them appeared only once. She was actually a character that appeared in Dial H for Hero.
That's interesting. That's really cool.
I have to look that up. I have all those comics.
That was a very interesting concept for a book.
Yeah, that was a fun series. The early 80s, that was Carmine Infantino was drawing it back then. And mm-hmm. I submitted a hero, which they absolutely did not use.
I don't know if you guys have heard of it, but I highly recommend they actually like did a new Dial H for Hero fairly recently.
Yes,
It's really good.
It was really good.
It's more of an homage to like the history of comics, which I think is really well done. And if you've not checked it out, I thought it was pretty good.
Cool. They've all been good. I mean, yeah. I know this is a major tangent at this point, but there've been like maybe six different versions of Dial H for Hero going back to the 60s. And they've all been very different, and they've all been very good in their own way.
Yeah. And we reviewed it on the podcast too. I'm impressed, Cletus. You doing all that research.
That was good.
All right. And for my shout out. All right. I'm going to shout out about the 42 cast episode 120, because Nathan Laws interviews interviews Alex Garfin, who plays Jordan Kent on the Superman and Lois television show. So if you want to check that out, that's it's already been released.
Score
so.
For Nathan.
Yeah.
And that is a fantastic TV series as well. If you're not watching it, that is an excellent version of Superman and Lois.
I'm several episodes behind, but I have been enjoying it more or less. I'm very impressed that Nathan got that actor on 42 cast right here on ESO. That's great.
Yeah, it was. I thought it was pretty cool. And of
the
course,
the most famous guest I've ever had on the Flopcast is it's you. It was Drew Leiter we had on a few weeks ago, and you were by far our biggest name guest ever.
Look, he's speechless.
I wish I was being sarcastic.
Drew, have you been moved to tears?
Oh, sorry, I was on mute.
That was while he was saying all those nice things about your podcast, Kevin.
That's right.
Oh, what I wanted to say was I was watching Superman and Lois before the podcast tonight. I was watching the new episode starting on next week's, getting things ready for next week's podcast. I usually watch it on my Fire tablet, but I couldn't get the episode to play. I was getting so mad. It was just giving me an error. I went upstairs to the Fire TV we have up there, played fine there, but I couldn't get it to play on my tablet. So, yeah, I got mad at that, but I'm really loving that show. And we only got two more episodes left for the first season. So, and of course, we've been reviewing it on the show.
I've been quite impressed with it. It's quite good.
All right. If you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about tonight, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-564-9133. Leave us a message, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus. Coming up next week, we got Batman, The Adventures Continue, season number 2, Batman Urban Legends, Batman 89, Future State Gotham, Justice League Ride, Rorschach, I Am Batman, The Joker, Detective Comics, Infinite Frontier, Wonder Woman, and of course our DC television show, Superman and Lois, Stargirl season premiere, Legends of Tomorrow, and Sweet Tooth. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Wonder Woman! Wonder Woman!
All the world is waiting for you and the power you possess. In your satin tights, fighting for your rights,
and the old red, white, and blue.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.